Today is Saturday. Today's Sunday? It is Sunday. Today's Sunday, December 13th. Thank you. I've lost a whole day again. Well, we'll take it from the top. Today is Sunday, December 13th, 2020. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. And Jim, thank you so much for getting me into the right date and time here. I really appreciate that. You're doing all right today?
I'm doing great. Yeah, it's a good day here in Vancouver.
Good. Do you mind if we record this oral history over the telephone?
Not at all, Tom.
Thank you so much. Last time you had gotten us to the fall of 1974, after your decision in the spring of 1973 to go back to university. And this was the University of Arizona, Tucson. Can you pick that thread up for me?
That's right, yeah. So, it's always a little awkward to get into this, Tom, but then once we start talking, it just kind of flows so readily. So bear with me for a moment here while I gear up for it. But, we had mentioned last week, or I had mentioned that, I've been climbing with my friend Chris at Joshua Tree and in Colorado and all sorts of places and working part-time here and there to finance all that. But ultimately, I think both of us knew that we were destined to go into the university system for just because we were more interested in the world than just rock climbing, right?
Yeah.
And so you want to know if there's something else you can do. And so I had the thought that it was time to go to the university because I hadn't really been to a significant university yet other than just a community college. And so I went down to Tucson there, and I had some friends there from high school. An old girlfriend of mine, actually, from high school was living in Tucson at the time, and her best friend. And we'd actually done some hikes in the Grand Canyon, the three of us, before, all this time period. So I went down there and promptly enrolled in the astronomy program at University
Ooh.
Of Arizona. Yeah. And I was pretty naive back then. And I realized quite quickly, actually, on about day three, that astronomy and I were never going to come together, right? At least not as taught at University of Arizona.
I mean, I'm thinking that was a powerhouse school. They had Kitt Peak down there, and they had mathematics down there, and it would have, yeah. Hmm.
Oh yeah, and I was in this freshman class of astronomy. It wasn't this astronomy for Mickey Mouse players. It was astronomy for the astronomy majors, right?
Okay.
And there's
okay.
like 50 of us or 75 of us in this class. And the first day, they're throwing out all these differential equations on the board,
wow.
And chalkboard. And I just was way in over my head. I realized it right away. So I pulled out of that and went into astronomy for jocks, which was fine. That was great. I learned a lot and was taking other courses as well. So, and at that point I decided to become a French major. So,
okay.
French became, the core courses that I was taking. And,
Wait. Why French? I'm just like, wait a minute. Did I miss this in the first two interviews? This is love suddenly of.
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, my mother's sister, my aunt Judy, she had spent some time in Paris and she had learned French,
wow.
and gone to university and was a French major,
wow.
At the University of Stony Brook in New York, and that was in the early '60s, and my aunt was only about 10 years older than me.
Okay.
So she was quite a bit younger than my mother, right?
Yeah.
So she was a big influence on me, and we
wow.
would always, when we visited her, she would always speak French with my sisters and I, right?
Cool.
And so we learned rudimentary French from her, and then I took it in high school, and, I was pretty proficient at it.
Okay.
And I also took some German in high school, 2 years of German, 3 years of French. And so going into French in the university seemed, very natural, right?
Okay. All right.
Because I had the background in it, and it was fun. So But it wasn't hard. It wasn't rigorous, right? It wasn't disciplined. I mean, I don't know what I'm trying to say here. You had to do your homework, no question about that.
Right.
And you had to work hard at it. But it just didn't have the, you know, the logical framework that, you know, sciences have.
I guess I'm thinking of a three-letter word your mom and dad would have been looking at you asking about called a J-O-B.
Yes, right.
With a diploma.
Aunt, well, my aunt had an answer for that, too. She said, don't worry about it. You'll always be able to get a job in translation. Like, maybe you can work at the United Nations as a translator.
All right.
And,
good,
you know,
good comeback.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, we were lucky back then because you didn't have to worry so much about getting a job, you know, the J-O-B. Mm. You know, if you had a middle-class upbringing like myself, which I'm so thankful for,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If you had the right circumstances, you know, these days we can say if you were white,
mm-hmm.
you know, you had mm-hmm. extra options available to you. And so at that time, I was part of that cohort of America that, you know, didn't really have to worry about jobs because they were kind of there.
Right.
Waiting,
okay.
If you could get through these programs, and so it was a very fortunate time to be growing up and going to school, and you could pursue, you know, your interests. At least this is the way I approached it, was pursue your interests, academic interests, intellectual interests, without having to worry about that, you
right.
know, and I always worked through college, through university. I got some grants and stuff like that, but I also worked a lot, you know, to support myself and my climbing habits, and I always knew that jobs, you know, because I'd always worked, I always assumed I would have a job,
mm-hmm.
so we didn't have to worry about getting job per se, and not like kids today, you know.
Right.
I agree that it's a challenge for young people today, you know, unless you're heavily focused on the STEM. Disciplines, science, technology, engineering, math,
mm-hmm.
You know, where jobs are fairly abundant there, but that requires a lot of work and a lot of discipline and
yes.
and not and, and aptitude, you know, for types of thinking that a lot of people don't necessarily have an adaptation for. So, yeah, I consider myself to have been very fortunate to have lived at that time and not to have to worry so much about getting a job. And as a result, I could dabble, you know. I could kind of go into French and just see how it would turn out, right?
Cool, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it went.
Okay. And I'm thinking that in the fall of 1974, in Tucson, you're surrounded by mountains.
Yeah.
And so on a weekend, or if there was a light day at school and you were good on a class, you might even just go for a hike somewhere.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah! It was such a wonderful place to go to university, right? Because you've got the Santa Catalinas to the north, Santa Rita's to the east. What's the range to the south? Santa. I forget the name.
Let's see. Oh, I can figure this out. The Sarita's. No.
Yeah.
Out that way, but across the Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
From the Santa Rita's.
Santa Rita's. Yeah.
Is a range of mountains heading down, well, not quite Kitt Peak and Bob O'Keevery, but kind of off in that direction. So anyway.
Yeah, so south of Tucson and heading down to the Mexican border there.
Yeah.
And you know, wonderful hiking, just wonderful hiking, and of course in Arizona it's really easy to go off trail, right? Because
yeah.
you know the vegetation is typically open and you can see where you're going, and you can anticipate or see cliffs and figure out how to get around them. You know, I quickly started going all over these mountain ranges and hiking. And initially when I was down there, I didn't have a lot of climbing contacts. It's not like there was, you know, a bunch of people that traveled with me down to Tucson,
right.
A bunch of climbers. And so you kind of had to find these people, and another friend of mine from Phoenix moved down to Tucson as well. His name was Jim Garber, G-A-R-B-E-R, and he he and I had climbed also in the Phoenix area, and he decided he was going to go to university in Tucson too. So he came down sometime that year, and so you know we started to have this Phoenix contingent of climbers down there. But and of course there was a Tucson contingent, right? Tucson was already, they had a very high caliber climbing community present there.
So were you aware of the Southern Arizona Hiking Club and the Ramblers, the University of Arizona Ramblers? Were you aware of those groups?
I knew about them, but I never participated in any of their activities.
Okay.
And it's simply because I just was able to go out on my own, right?
Sure.
Or with friends that I knew, and we could do these things.
And
I guess, you know, if you move to another part of the country where you have no familiarity with the environment, you know, the logistics of hiking there or anything about, you know, the trail systems, et cetera, then it's, you know, quite useful to hook up with one of these organizations and get your feet wet, learn about the area you're in. But, of course, I'd read so much about all of Arizona when I was in high school, and I knew a lot about the geography and the trail systems, quite honestly, in like the Santa Catalinas before I even got there. So you know, it wasn't like and we'd had so much experience hiking and climbing in the desert before I went to Tucson that it was just a natural thing to just start going out, you know, immediately on your own.
Okay.
And so I never participated in those group things. And partly that, too, was I kind of have been a loner, you know, for a lot of my life. I mean, I've always had a few very close friends, but I'm not that comfortable in large groups, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And so the idea of going out with six or eight people on a hike is not that appealing to me, and going to a club meeting where you would talk about hiking is kind of just a little bit less appealing, right?
Yeah, sure.
So that was definitely a contributing factor too.
Okay.
Right?
All right. Yeah. Well, fair enough. I just want to ask, because those are kind of, if you're into group hiking, those were the powerhouse groups down there.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
Just wanted to check
on
that.
And so, there was the local climbing place community was centered around the Summit Hut.
Yep.
And Dave Baker, do you know Dave Baker?
Yes.
Yeah, he ran that, and you know, he was at the forefront of rock climbing in Tucson at that time, and had been for quite some time since the late 60s. And so we used to go to his shop, and that's where we got information about climbs before the guidebooks were published, you know. There would be he had like a couple of binders of typed up or handwritten notes that people would put in the binder, you know, to talk about routes so we got information that way, there was a very well established climbing community and network in the Tucson area that you know we tapped into, and we're very thankful that you know all this information existed, and particularly that Dave was there and would give us advice and tell us, you know, what protection was going to be needed on this pitch, et cetera, you know.
Right. Nice. And, of course, the Catalinas, this is granite, back into some good climbing rock. With some challenging climbs there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. And I just loved it. I mean, there were so many fantastic climbs. And quite honestly, my friend Chris came down and he may have been in 75, the latter part of 75. I'm not sure when he arrived, but I did spend more time, I think, climbing with Jim Garber in Tucson, and Jim and I hit it off really well. And I've lost touch with him now. You know, it's been 40 years, I guess, or longer, and I have no idea what he's doing. But he had spent some time. He's a little bit older than me, and had spent some time at the University of Colorado Boulder. So he'd done a lot of climbing
up there
in the Boulder area, right?
Okay.
And he was very methodical, very precise, calm climber. I learned a lot from him, you know, as to technique, and so it was very very rewarding, and he was cl- climbing a little bit better than me.
Okay.
So, you know, he could do the harder leads, and then I would come up and be able to follow him, you know, and learn how to do that. And then
cool.
eventually I'd be able to lead that pitch, you know, on the next time we did that climb. And
cool.
So it was, yeah, it was a good way to push yourself, you know, and I think probably, well, there was, you know, there were a number of highlights of my climbing career down in Tucson, but
give me a couple.
Well, okay, probably the neatest thing was when we did this first, not first ascent, but the first 5-10 for me, which is a 5-10 climb, right, of difficulty, and they weren't that common then, you know. I mean, they were doing 5-11 in Yosemite
right.
at that time, and so, you know, it was 5-10 was pretty far up there, and you know, they had these new shoes called, at the time, called EBs. They were called, actually, that was a short name. The real name was Ellis Brigham, who was a British a climber and gear designer, and he designed these shoes with the smooth sole and the very, very sticky rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would get your EBs. I think they cost like $40 a pair, and then we actually took them into a cobbler and had him put leather panels on the sides, you know, above the sole to protect the fragile canvas against abrasion, right? So the shoes would last longer. And
as I recall, these were sort of like ballerina shoes. They were tight. They fit really, you sort of, you know, bound to your foot. It wasn't like there was a lot of room in there to slop around.
Oh, no, they were very uncomfortable. In fact, you know, usually you would climb a pitch and then you'd take your shoes off while your partner climbed either above you or coming up, you know, from below.
Hmm.
And you'd take your shoes off and let your feet just air out and let your toes kind of spread out, you know, because they were so tightly, as you pointed out, it's so tightly you know, tied down in these shoes. And that's the way you bought them, was to be really, really tight. And they were really painful, you know, if you stop to think about it. But most of the time you're focused on the climbing and you're not thinking about the pain in your feet, you know. So, but you know, we were able to do this climb called Voodoo Child. That's what it was. And it had this 5-10 face climb. And
where was it?
It was up on Rappel Rock at the top of the Catalinas. So it's a big granite dome there. And
up at Windy Point or up beyond that?
Up above that,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you go all the way up to Summer Haven there,
yeah,
the town,
yeah.
And then you drive along a dirt road along to the west,
okay,
along the spine of the mountains there, just a little ways, and maybe a mile or something, and you can then, you're at the top of the dome, and then you can scramble down, and you know, it's just so, well, you spent a lot of time in Arizona, so you know what it's like up on these sky islands, you know, down in the southern part of the state there, you know, with, you can be up there in the summertime, and it's 110 degrees down in Tucson, and it's only 80 up there, or 78. You
magical.
Know? And it is, and you're up there, and it's cool, and the breeze is blowing through the ponderosas, and it's so quiet. You know, all you hear is the moaning, gentle moaning of the wind. It really was a fantastic place to hang out, you know,
nice.
And climb. So, yeah, Voodoo Child was one of our highlights, I think, but there were so many climbs up there that, you know, as we mentioned, I think before the tape machine started, you know, you have these recollections come back to you, and you may not remember exactly when it was, you know, as far as the dates, but you remember the experiences, I have so many positive memories that about, you know, that time and those places. Again, partly because of the mystique and the fantastic beauty of Arizona, you know, from an outdoor perspective.
Yeah. So did you get up to Grand Canyon at all there in the fall of 74 into 75?
Yeah. I'm actually looking at my notes, right? Mm. I'm a little bit more prepared this time.
Because, okay. All right.
I figured I might as well have my notes here.
Okay.
So that I can understand the framework, you know, the chronological framework.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, certainly, you know, we were doing as you asked me earlier about going out climbing after, you know, after school.
Yeah.
And we did that all the time and hiking and whatnot. And so it was like, you know, on the weekends, you'd go out, say to Babbo and try a climb there, Baba Kivri, or up in the Santa Catalinas, maybe camp out at the top of Rappel Rock there, and then, you know, climb all day Saturday and half day Sunday, and but then periodically, you know, I did go up to the canyon, so I was doing weekend trips more or less, you know, sometimes a little bit longer around holidays, school holidays, you know, when you have a more extended break.
Right.
Yeah. So, but it wasn't. It was mostly just ticking off the non-maintained trails at that point, right?
Yep.
And so I had, thank you, Renee. My wife just, she brings in a glass of wine every week when we do this, Tom, and it's kind of a surprise because I don't know what's coming, and then, but it's kind of, it's a nice addition to our discussion.
Yeah, it helps the interview go a little easier.
Yeah.
Cuts the pain.
Yeah, that's right. So, so anyways, I was trying to, at that point, you know, I at that point, I didn't have a really solid understanding of the Grand Canyon yet. And,
okay.
And so, you know, remember that little pamphlet, that little TAM pamphlet called Inner Canyon Hiking,
mm-hmm.
that was printed in around 1970, I guess. And it had a brief description of each of the non-maintained trails. And so, you know, at that point in my life, I was kind of interested in ticking off those trails, right?
Okay.
And just kind of getting into these more remote parts of the canyon. And then, of course, you know, that pamphlet was supplemented by Butchert's Grand Canyon Treks.
Right.
Treks 1. And, of course, at that time, we had no idea that maybe even Harvey didn't know there was going to be a Treks 2 or 3. But that book was such a Bible for us, you know. It's just like we knew every passage in that book. It was just so exciting to read about his travels. And he always, Harvey always gave you just enough information to excite you, but not enough information so that you knew what you were getting into, right?
That's what mathematicians do.
Yeah, that's, I guess that's true.
You know, I want you to figure this out. I'm going to give you the formula. I know how, you know how to do it. Here's, you know, what is A plus B equals C? What is it? You know, so you're like, okay, well, he did it. I'll go out and try it. And that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was like, that was just so stimulating.
Did you meet him at that time?
Not then, no. It was in the late 90s when I finally met him.
Okay, all right.
So I we corresponded. I mean, I wrote to him 3 or 4 times and got very very nice letters back.
Nice.
You know? Yeah, and but you know, I mean, I felt like he was this god, right?
Mm.
You know, living up in the Grand Canyon in Flagstaff and going to the Grand Canyon every weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I was very, I won't say intimidated, but I just felt like, you know, I got a lot to learn before I mingle with that crowd, you know what I mean? And so, no, I was pretty content with just doing these hikes and ticking off the trails. But going into different parts of the canyon, you know, and learning that, oh, yeah, I can drive my Volkswagen Bug. I mean, I had a Carnegie at the time. I can drive that out to the Bass Trailhead, you know.
Yeah.
If the roads are right, I can make it out there. And you know, learning this kind of information, you start to see that you can get into a lot more of these remote places, you know, that that Harvey had been to, or that just were places on the map. That's what the objective at that time for me in Grand Canyon was. It wasn't going after the summits. It was basically just to do great hikes there, you
yeah,
know.
Okay.
And I mean, it was, you know, so fascinating to find Anasazi pueblos and dwellings and storehouses and things like that where you weren't expecting them, or to find, you know, that you could get through cliffs, right, and that looked kind of dicey, and but there was a way, you know, and Harvey been through here, my goodness, so there's got to be a
mm-hmm,
way. We
mm-hmm.
just got to figure it out, you know.
Yeah.
And
cool.
Yeah. So that was a kind of a natural progression. You know, I did take a big trip. It was actually in 73 before I went down to Arizona. You know, I'd read this book when I was a kid, like in the mid-60s, by Colin Fletcher. The Man Who Walked Through Time.
Yeah.
And so this is when I lived in Dallas. I read this book. And I thought, this is so cool. And I think in the first discussion we had, you and I had here, I talked about how when I was a little kid and we came up from Phoenix and we read Hermit's Rest and looking down at you know, the terrace where the Boucher Trail goes. You couldn't see the trail, but but I could just see this topography, and that's when I really became enamored of hiking in the canyon. And to find this book, you know, around 1966 or 67, about this guy who had actually walked through the entire canyon, or a significant part of it, was really, you know, inspirational. And so I kind of wanted to do a similar type thing. I decided that I needed to emulate Fletcher, you know. And so I did a 35-day trip from – I was supposed to go from Hack Canyon, which is a tributary to Kanab Creek.
Yep.
And then I was going to hike around to Nanqui, but on the north side of the river, right?
Okay.
Because Fletcher had done it on the south side. And so I did that trip, and I made it to Phantom. That's as far as I got.
Wow, pretty good.
It was a good trip, yeah. And but I just kind of burned out, and I needed human contact, you know.
Okay.
I saw.
So
like,
so you're doing this solo?
Yeah, I did that trip solo. Yeah.
And did you place any caches along the way before
you?
Yeah,
I had put out a couple of caches. One at the North Bass.
Okay.
And then I had put out a cache at Phantom Ranch.
Okay.
And I had put out a cache. Well, not at Phantom Ranch, but I put it out at the junction with Phantom Creek and Bright Angel Creek.
So Roaring
and then
Springs up there.
Yeah, not quite up to Roaring Springs, but just about a mile above Phantom Ranch, and then
okay.
I had another cache too down deep in Kanab Creek, and that, which was neat because that was right.
If you started at Hack, would you put one in Kanab?
Yeah. Well, here's what I did.
Yeah.
And this was right around the time of the Watergate hearings. Because
okay.
I remember, you know, it was in the winter, or springtime, I guess, but transition from winter. And they were having the Watergate hearings. And I remember I hitchhiked up to Northern California with a food cache, right, that I knew I had to put down in Kanab Creek.
Okay.
And so the weather wasn't that great, and I had some time to kill, and I had a few bucks in my pocket, not many, but I got this little tiny cabin in Fredonia, and I put all my gear out, and I was packing my gear and listening to the Watergate hearings while it rained outside, you know. And then the next day, I walked, put on my pack, and walked out of the hotel and just walked just west of Fredonia there, like a few hundred meters, I guess it is. Maybe it's a mile, and that's where Kanab Creek goes.
Right.
Crosses under the highway there.
Okay.
And so I started walking down the creek, you know,
oh,
heading for the Colorado River.
All right. I was thinking about Hack, that you actually drove out the Toroweep Road and then turned down the Hack Canyon toward the old uranium mine and started in there. But if you started, that's where you would need a cache then at Hack if you started up at Fredonia.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
That's right.
What was that? I've never walked that section from Fredonia to Hack. What was that like?
I thought it was really neat because, you know, you really move slowly down through the canyon there because it's such a long distance.
Yeah.
You know, your descent, rate of descent down in through the geology is relatively slow. And so, there's not much, you know, there's not much in the way of obstructions until you get to the Red Wall, you know, when you're down deep in the
Red Wall.
Quite
a ways, yeah. You've got to walk and miles and miles to get there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was just me and the cows. I remember that there were just lots of cattle in there, and which was kind of beneficial because they had put these, you know, they'd made these trails
right.
that were easy to follow and through the brush on the sides of the creek.
You know, you mentioned it was raining. Was there water running in the creek?
Oh yeah, there was water up there, and it was like it was filthy mud, right?
Right.
And so I would have to. I had like 2 1-quart Nalgene bottles.
Right.
And because it was winter, it was cool, right? And so I wasn't sweating a whole lot, and I would overnight collect water out of the creek, and by the morning time, you know, like an inch and a half of mud had settled to the bottom, and I would decant the cloudy brown water, you know, into right. another bottle, and then that's what I would. I had enough for a day's worth of drinking, really.
Okay.
And it was quite a mess, quite a messy solution. But I didn't mind it, you know. I dealt with it, and I didn't get sick. So
right. Except you just have to cross the creek every now and then, or I guess you didn't. You got the hack. You definitely needed to be to your cache. You needed to be on the west side of the creek. And if you started at Fredonia, I don't know, did you start on the east side? You got to cross it somewhere.
Yeah, so what happened was, you know, I hiked down into the Red Wall about half the way through the Red Wall, and that's where I put the cache.
Ah.
Okay, so the cache was in it was in a couple of large brass cans.
Okay,
and I had like you know fuel bottles, cig bottles of white gas in there for my stove, and you know. Plastic baggies with oatmeal and stuff like that, and clean socks, but that's where I dropped the cache, and then I walked back up hack, okay, and that's how I got out from just putting in the cache.
Okay.
So then I came back the next year, so next spring, or later. Wait a minute, that would have been I guess that was in the. Definitely the Watergate hearings. We had to look and see what time of year that was. Maybe that was in the fall. And so this would have been the beginning of the winter season. And, well, let me check my notes here. Sorry for these interruptions.
No worries.
Yeah, late January 73 is when I went down into Kanab Creek there and dropped that cache off. So then in May of 73, after I'd put out the cache in Phantom Creek, and then I had Gaylord Staveley put out the cache for me at the mouth of Shinimo, right? And so in May, then I started the big trip, and I went back to Hack. I hitchhiked up there. Believe it or not, I was able to hitchhike to within 15 miles, I guess, of Hack Canyon.
Wow.
Came back down, and then walked to Phantom in May. So,
okay, so
that was the chronology.
May of 73. Now, you mentioned Gaylord Staveley, Staveley.
Yeah.
How did you meet Gaylord?
Well, I knew that I needed to put out a cache.
Okay.
And in the Shinimo area. And I just thought, well, I'll go ask these river runners who were going down there all the time.
Okay.
And so he had a small place on the north side of Flagstaff there.
Uh-huh.
At the top of the hill, you know.
Yep.
Before you drop down to the, what's that valley called?
Dead Man Flat there.
I guess so. It's very windy there.
Yeah, yeah. That side of East Flag.
East Flag.
Yeah.
And what was the name of his company?
Canyoneers.
Canyoneers, of course. Yeah. And so I just stopped in there one trip, and I said, "Would you be willing to put some, you know, a cache of food out for me?" And he said, "Sure, no problem." So he gave me a description of where he was going to leave the cache.
Okay.
And then I came back subsequently with it, right, and gave it to him. And then he put it out on one of his trips. And so, you know, so by then I had a cache at Phantom, which was going to get me the last 2 weeks around to Nankoweap. And then I had a cache at Shinimo, and I had a cache down in deep in Kanab Creek. And so then I started on the big trip, and that's how I got
in
to
Phantom. In May of 73.
Yeah, that's
And so
right.
you drove out to, no, you hitchhiked. Out to pretty close to the start of Hack Canyon.
Yeah.
And then so you had to walk from the Toro Weep Road all the way down Hack.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And it's a beautiful area,
yeah.
If you've been into that area. And of course the old uranium mines are down there in Hack.
Yeah.
So it's a fun place to poke around
yep.
and explore.
Now
you know?
had at Hack, you had a couple options. One was to go down Kanab to the river and then hike up along the river, or you could go up, jump up a ways, and then cut around to the Fishtail Saddle. Were you aware of the high and low routes? How did you map that out?
No, I have to say, Tom, I was really ignorant of how to get around in the canyon at this point.
Okay.
I mean, I knew I had these non-maintained trails. I hadn't hiked them all at that point, but I had read about them, and I kind of knew generally, you know, where they were and the details there. But I didn't know a whole lot about cross country. I knew one could do it easily, you know, because of my hiking experience in the desert.
Right.
But I hadn't actually developed a strong familiarity with all the routes, you know, and where things were feasible. And to be quite honest with you, it's an embarrassment to say it now. But before I went on this long trip, I actually talked with the Park Service, right, to let them know I was going to be out there.
Yep.
And I spoke with the superintendent, or I guess he was the chief ranger at the time, named Ernie Kunzel. And he was really supportive. The only thing he demanded was that I take along some sort of a primitive ELT, which basically, if you hit the switch, it sent a signal up to on an airliner frequency.
Okay.
And I understood it was to be, you know, for civilian use, it was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we agreed that given the circumstances, being solo hiking out like this, it would make sense for me to carry this. If something happened, I would use that, right?
Well, good for Ernie. That's Kunzel is his spelling.
It might have been Kunzel. I'm not sure.
C. Kunzel.
Z as in zebra.
No, C as in Charlie.
Okay, you're correcting me. Fair enough. That's good to know. Anyways, so Ernie had put this one proviso on me, but otherwise given me the okay. He did raise his eyebrows when I told him I'd put out several caches, and he said, "Well, you know, you should have had a permit for that." And I said, "Oh, okay. I didn't realize that." Mm-hmm. You know, I was 19 at the time, right?
Okay.
So I was pretty naive. But to get back to my embarrassment story, you know, I had gone into the park and to meet with Ernie, and he had wanted me to show him where I was going to be going, you know, what the approximate route was going to be. And so I knew I could hike upriver, you know, at least to Bedrock and Galloway and Stone, right?
Right.
Because that was in Harvey's Treks. And I actually had sketched out for Ernie that I would head up one of these canyons like Bedrock or Galloway and go through the Red Wall to get up high,
right?
And, you know, which is totally ridiculous.
No, there's a route there. It goes. It's really hard, but you know.
Where is it?
You can go up Galloway. We'll get you up through the Red Wall there. It's really hard. It's a very, you could have done it because you would have free soloed it. With your pack, it would have been a challenge. Kunzel wouldn't have known about it.
Yeah, for sure, because he told me there's no routes there.
Okay.
He did say, "I've spoken with my ranger, one of my rangers, and there's no routes there." And quite honestly, I've been up every one of these canyons from the river all around Powell Plateau, every one of them with the exception of Hakatai.
Okay.
Which I've been down to, you know, from the Tonto. I've been down the river,
mm-hmm.
But I haven't gone up Hakatai. And the only other one that I haven't gone up is Galloway. And so I never have pushed through up to there and seen that. So this is the first time I'm learning about this, right? This route.
But,
oh, man,
this is
great.
So Ernie would have said, "Well, there's a little problem with your plan here because you can't go the way you're thinking to go."
Yeah, that's exactly what he said. And I said, then I guess I'll just carry on upriver, or I'll go up to Pete's Creek, you know, up Saddle Canyon in that way. And you know, I don't know what he was thinking. You know, he had this young kid there, and he thought that maybe I was never even going to do this hike, you know. But he basically said, "Okay, kid, you know.
How cool is that?
Let us know when you start and let us know when you end."
Huh.
And so he was quite supportive. And I heard, you know, talking to other people who worked with him and who knew him, you know, they had a different opinion of him, right? That he was a little more brusque and restrictive. But he was very gentlemanly with me and very supportive. I certainly remember that, you know, he could have put a kibosh on this project anytime,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, he never did. So
very cool.
Yeah, it was a very nice trip. So I did, that was the
Okay, so
major thing I had under my belt by the time I,
let's back up and talk about this. I'm not letting you out of this 1973 trip just yet.
Okay.
So down Hakkatai, this is in May of 73. You've already...
Hack.
Sorry, Hack. Down Hack.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm thinking Hakkatai. Down Hack, H-A-C-K. And then did you just simply hang a right and walk Kanab all the way to the river?
That's what I did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I didn't know, I didn't know very much at all about the options, of
yep.
getting out of Kanab.
Okay.
And
then at the river, you would have said, well, okay, now I'm going to go up along the river, and you would have saw river trips going the other way if they even saw you.
Quite honestly, I saw one river trip.
Okay.
And so they were, it was around Fishtail,
Yep.
So
you're still heading east to Deer Creek and to Pete's Creek.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I could see these people on the river and I was close to the side. I'm sure they didn't see me. I don't know. And they didn't wave back, right?
Right.
But a couple of rafts, maybe three or four, and motorized.
Okay.
And so they went by and then I just continued up river to Deer Creek and hung out there. There was nobody there,
Wow.
And spent, I wasn't spending a whole lot of time. I was relaxing. I was
mm-hmm.
I was kind of stressed to be honest,
mm-hmm.
because of the solo aspect of it. So
yep.
I kept moving repeatedly,
okay.
Continuously. And
so at Deer Creek, and again, Grand Canyon, Harvey's Grand Canyon Trex 1 was out. Had he described the route from the river Deer Creek up to Dutton Spring and then across to Thunder River and then down to Pete's Creek back to the river? Did you know that route existed?
Yeah, I knew that.
Okay.
I knew that. I knew I could. I knew that's the way I should go. Right.
Yep.
To this day, I still haven't hiked from Deer Creek up river past Bonita.
Okay.
To Deer Creek.
On the.
I'm sorry. To Pete's Creek.
On the river route. Sure.
On the river.
So
yeah, river.
So that up and over must have been a highway for you.
Oh yeah, yeah, it was, because even at that point, this would have 73, right? There were good river runner hikes.
Lots
trails.
Of river runner trails. There.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So yeah, I hiked up and over the trail through Surprise Valley and then down to Thunder River, and that's where I ran into my first problem.
Hmm.
And I got down to Pete's Creek, and there's a little campsite there, and it was deserted. There's nobody there, right? Because this is May of 73, so the roads haven't even really opened up into the North Rim yet. And to Pete's Creek, I was just looking at it, and it was like a cataclysm of water.
Yes.
And you could hear these giant boulders rumbling along in
wow.
the creek bed, And I thought, I can't cross this, There's just no way I can cross this safely. And keep in mind, I'd been up in Wyoming, and we'd crossed, huge alpine rivers. And so I knew how to get across these things, and I could recognize that this was not going to happen.
Okay.
And so there I am, stuck on the west side of to Peach Creek and wondering how I'm going to get across, and I realized I couldn't. So I realized I had to backtrack and then go up to the Esplanade and then follow the Esplanade around to Moab Saddle.
Okay.
So my plan had been to go across to Pete's and go down to Pete's and then pick up the trail along the river into Galloway or Bedrock, and naively I was going to climb up through the Red Wall in one of those two. I might have made it now in
mm-hmm,
Galloway,
mm-hmm.
according
yep.
to what you tell me. And then I was going to get up to the Esplanade there and then follow that around over to White Canyon, right,
mm-hmm,
and the North
mm-hmm.
Bass Trail.
Right.
So, but that basically was out of the question. So I had to rethink this, and I said, okay, well, I'll go back over to the trail up to Indian Hollow and then go up that trail and then follow the Esplanade around, I'm not sure what Harvey had said in Trek 1 about trails in there, but I knew, you know, one can walk forever on the Esplanade, basically, you know, and so I knew it would be straightforward eventually to get around to Moab's Saddle that way.
Okay.
So that's what I did, and
ooh, all right.
I ran into a ranger coming down with a couple of horses down the. He was in the Red Wall then.
Oh.
And he was coming down to do some.
So he was between the Esplanade and the top of the Red Wall on the Bill Hall route of the Tepetz Creek Thunder River Trail.
No, he was in. He was. You know the. There's a little bit of supai that you drop down through when you come off the Esplanade, and then you drop down into the Red Wall,
mm-hmm.
which is all a big slide.
Right.
Right? This is on the Surprise Valley Trail.
Yeah, that's we're talking about the same thing. We're just giving it different names. Sure.
Okay, yeah. So I was not up on the Esplanade level yet.
And he would have been a forest ranger?
Forest ranger.
Yeah, National Forest Service.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I have no idea what his name was, you know, mm-hmm. but other than those river runners that I'd seen from a distance, you know, I hadn't seen anybody at this point for a couple of weeks.
Okay.
So, we had a good chat,
cool.
You know, and I explained to him what I was doing and attempting to do, and you know, it was neat to talk to somebody. I think I gave him a letter to my girlfriend at the time.
Oh.
I think this is just coming back to me now. But, you know, I carried a few envelopes and stamps and paper, right, to in case I ran into people. And now this just came to my mind. I'm pretty sure I gave him a letter that I would have sent to
nice.
To my girlfriend.
Send a note out to Ernie Kunzel, tell him I'm alive.
Yeah, right.
Huh.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, so the only thing about the Esplanade that I think of going up to Moab Saddle, up to the top of White Canyon, is the vegetation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was grim. You know, it wasn't so bad going around to Crazy Jug and then coming along the east side of Crazy Jug over to, Timp, I guess. And then, but then you start getting, the terrain is slowly rising, right?
Yep.
The topography is slowly rising, and you're getting more vegetation in there. And I remember these long flats of manzanita and having to literally crash through, you know, busting my way through manzanita clumps. And it was just really slow going. It took me basically 2 days to go from the head of Crazy Jug up to Moab Saddle because of that manzanita. And quite honestly, I've been back there since several times, and I've just cruised there. I don't know what the problem was in 73, but maybe it's just I didn't understand how manzanita was distributed on the Esplanade.
Right.
But I wound up going through these thickets that were just horrible and really, you know, psychologically defeating, right?
Yes.
And you know, you're out there by yourself and you're having to, you know, I've already had to backtrack off my route because of this you know, spring melt in
right.
Tepetz Creek. And it was a little daunting so to run into this manzanita was even it just added to the mix, right?
Yeah.
But eventually that passed. I got through it and got up to the saddle there and stayed in the cabin, right? The Teddy Roosevelt cabin.
Yep.
And
was there snow? Was there snow, you know, just up above you, or were you in snow at the cabin?
Yeah, there was a little bit. There was some patches of snow. There
okay.
wasn't much.
Okay.
It's I've been there at times when there's been a few feet. And but at this time, it was just a few patches here and there.
What
right?
kind of shape was the cabin in at that time?
Yeah, it was not in great shape, and
okay.
I remember it was kind of run down.
Mm-hmm.
There were like mattresses with steel springs, you know,
yep.
that were all kind of the mattresses were all rotten, you know.
Okay.
And I didn't actually sleep in the cabin. I just slept outside, you know, on my ground cloth. Because you're afraid of rats and mice and everything
else. Was there a logbook in there at all?
I don't remember a logbook at that time.
Okay.
No, I can't recall that there was. There may have been. There may have been.
I'm just thinking that Robert Benson would have been all over that area, and I just can't remember when he was in there. Whether it was a little earlier or right about that same time. So,
You've been to the cabin probably many times, huh?
Well, a couple. But...
Yeah, and there's a logbook there now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just, do you know how long it goes back? How far it goes back?
That's you know, into the 90s, but again, it these things cycle through. They fill up, and then a ranger will take them to the museum collection at the South Rim and archive them there and put in a new one. So that's what I was asking, was there one when you went through in 73? And if not, then not. And again, that would have been off the, at that time, most likely would have been off the radar screen of the Rangers themselves. So
yeah. There could very well have been a logbook, and I could very well have signed it. I don't recall. I just something now I'm kind of thinking would be interesting to look up, you know, in the archives. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be good. I can connect you with who you need to ask if you want to do that.
Well, I've been in touch with Kim Beesom, thanks to your
introduction. Then you're good. Ask Kim. She's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so from there you would have linked on to the North Bass Trail, which again would have been a highway compared to what you just whacked through.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. And so it was a highway, but the problem, of course, Tom, which you may have twigged onto, was my Tapete Creek problem, was that it was spring melt.
Okay, yep.
And so I came down the North Bass, and that's the first time I'd ever been on the North Bass, coming down at that time. And like you say, it was a relative highway. I don't remember the details, but I do remember that that there wasn't much in the way of switchbacks or obvious route below the spring there, you know, just east of the saddle.
Yep.
You basically just worked your way down the slope, you know, slowly. And now there's just like just a huge scar of slid out Coconino talus. But you know, you worked your way down, and then you pick up the trail in the red wall. I remember going across the top of the red wall for like two or three drainages before you actually get to the top of the red wall descent, right? And there was no trail there, right? There might have been a couple of cairns or something like that, but you just had to crash through the brush, and eventually, you know, using your 1 to 62,500 scale 15-minute map, right, which was the best thing we had.
Right.
You could, you know, navigate to where you thought the top of the trail was supposed to be, and there it was, and it was cool to see, you know, the engineering down through the red wall there. And,
cool.
Yeah, so I went down to Shinumo Creek, and
now it's the water.
Yeah, and so, of course, my cache is at the mouth of Shinumo.
Okay.
Yeah, and the way Stavely had described it, you know, he said he was going to put it on some ledges kind of downstream from the mouth of the creek. And
holy cow, downstream. Why did he put it down there?
Well, I don't know, but that's what he said.
Okay.
And, you know, keep in mind, Tom, this is 47 years ago, right?
Yeah, but he knew where Bass Camp was, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, well, I think part of it was he, you know, we were talking, we wanted to kind of keep it secret.
Hidden.
I mean, we didn't want it to be obvious,
sure.
Right?
Sure, all right.
And if he put it at Bass Camp, then people might have, river runners or hikers might have found it. And you know, keep in mind these caches were out for several of them for 3 or 4 months, right?
Right.
So,
right.
So you know, I think he thought that that you know the river better than I. Once you pass Shinumo Creek, I'm not sure how easy it is to pull over, right? And so
it's people, not.
Yeah. So people, you know, if they wouldn't have been going down there, right?
But I also know that it's how are you going to get there? Now you're on. You're on the west side of the river as you come down off the red wall on the North Bass, but you can't just tromp right down the side of the drainage. You get cliffed out.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that's exactly what That's exactly what I realized. And again, this is the first time I'd been down the North Pass.
Right.
So I didn't know.
Right.
I didn't know the logistics. I didn't know that, you know, you had to get right down into the creek there, basically, and to navigate down the trail. So I get to the creek, and it's just running high, just like to Pete's Creek was. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I can't cross this creek. You know, it's just way too much water in here. So what am I going to do? So I thought, well, I'm going to have to backtrack again. So I did. I went back up the trail to the Tonto, up the back up the North Pass to to where it crossed the Tonto, and then I came down the east side of White Creek. Okay. Past the mouth of Red Wall Canyon there. And so basically, you know, at the same level as the North Pass Trail on the other side of White Creek.
Okay.
And following along on top of the Tonto. And so I basically followed at that level all the way around Holy Grail Temple into Merlin Abyss.
And Modred, yeah, Merlin and Modred Abysses.
Wow. And the water is still ripping, you know,
yep.
because it comes out of a huge spring up there in
That's
Upper
right.
Shinnimo Creek.
Yep.
And so the water was just ripping down there, and I'm getting kind of gripped, you know, because I didn't really know too much about this part of the world, you know. I didn't have a lot of – I had really no understanding of the detailed topography or in the routes in this part of the canyon, and I was kind of, you know, in extremis. And so
not
but
surprising.
Eventually, what's that?
I'm not surprising. This is a, you know, in 1973 with very little beta, you're on your own. You've bitten off quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was getting pretty apprehensive. And so at one point, you know, the shale is starting to pinch out in Merlin Abyss. And I'm starting to run out of options to get to continue up, you know, on the side of the drainage, right, on the side of the creek.
Right.
And I'm starting to realize I've got to come to some sort of a resolution here. And there was a tree that had fallen, a cottonwood that had fallen down across Shinnimo Creek.
Oh, wow.
And it was just, I mean, in my mind, my recollection after all this time is that it was, you know, this flimsy little thing. I don't remember how big it was, but it did go across the creek, right?
Woohoo!
Yeah.
A bridge!
And so, you know, it just didn't really look that stable. But I figured it was pretty much my only chance, right?
Wow.
My only hope was to get across there. Otherwise, I had to reverse the whole trip, right? And by this time, I was looking for food.
Right.
And so, anyways, I wound up taking my pack, and I went across without the pack on, right, to see how it was going to work. And then I came back after I made it. I came back and I got the pack, and you know, this whole time I was just super gripped because I'm scooting along on this tree and it's bouncing, and the water is just ripping along right at my feet, just underneath me.
It's terrifying in there.
It really is. And I was thinking, if I fall off this thing, that's it. You know, I'm going to be ground to pulp in the supai boulders that are
right.
going down through this creek. But I made it across, and you know, I have to say, when I got onto the other side, I collapsed on the ground. I was crying.
Uh-huh.
I was just so. It was such a release, you know, to be across this thing.
Wow.
And I mean, I didn't know what was ahead of me yet, but at least I'd gotten across that particular drainage, right?
Right.
And
right.
So
now you've got to work your way back down Shinnimo on Creek Left. That's no chore. That's no easy street either.
Yeah, and at this point, I started really worrying because I knew that my cache was on the other side of Shinnimo Creek.
Right.
And I was on, you know, that means I would have to cross that creek again.
Right.
Where it's even wider and more volume, or at least equal volume, right? And
right.
So I basically decided to forego the cache.
Oh, wow.
And elected to just bolt as fast as I could towards Phantom Creek. So, you know, I had a couple days of food at that point.
Okay.
It's not like I was totally out.
But it's tough because Well, I mean, there's a lot to it. Had you known the route that goes from today's bass camp down to Shinumu, to the mouth of Shinumu, the water there interfaces with the river, and it's fairly easy to get across right there because it's not raging by. It's backwatered up because of the Colorado. It's cold, but it's much easier to get across. You
Yeah.
swim if you need to. It's fairly deep, but
There's all sorts of options that I know about now,
now,
right?
yeah. But
But at
in
the time,
73, didn't know it. Yeah.
no, at the
Wow.
time it was
Wow.
just naivete and so I just decided to go from Flint Creek, to Phantom. And by that time I think I'd set it in my mind that I was done with this trip,
Okay. Okay.
but I did. So then I that point, then I made that decision, and I walked. I followed the Tonto around over into Flint Creek, and then climbed up the Red Wall at Flint. You've probably done that.
I haven't. I've circumvented it up above, but I hear stories about that section of Redwall there. How'd you do it?
Yeah, it. I didn't know anything except what Harvey had said, which was that, there was a route, of
Yep,
course. He didn't
yep.
really say much more than that.
Right.
And so I started up, and basically the way I could see it, and this is the way I've done it subsequently too on several occasions, you start up to the west.
Okay.
The route's on a big fin, a buttress of Red Wall,
Okay.
and you start up to the west of it and climb up through the shale, and then you traverse right across. And so as you come across on the horizontal at the base of the Red Wall, there's actually an option that you can look at, and it almost looks like it'll go. And so I got up to the base of that, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, could this be it? Is this the way to go? And I did the first couple of moves, and I thought, I don't know, man, this is really dicey looking. It's very steep, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I got to get past this. And so I said, okay, well, look, let's look around first and see if there's something else. And
Good.
so I followed along, horizontally on this ledge, and there was yet another face, but a little bit more broken. This one, I looked at and I said, I think this will go pretty straightforward, so I did it, but I was gripped. I have to say I was gripped. Which is so ironic because I've done that since two other times. And it's kind of like a piece of cake. It really is
Well,
straightforward.
when you did it the other time, were you solo?
Yeah, the first no, I had yeah, my friends Art and Bruce Grubbs with me,
Boy,
so
that makes such a difference.
yeah, it does for sure.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
yeah, so that that was kind of a that was kind of another epic day there. I think the rest of that trip over to Phantom was pretty straightforward. It was
Well,
essentially just following the.
let's not rush it because
Oh,
once you get
okay.
through the Red Wall, to get to the Flint Tuna saddle is another brushy nightmare.
Yeah, but I think at that point I was so thankful to be up above the Red Wall.
Okay.
Because keep in mind, I'd spent so much time below the Red Wall here wondering how I was going to get up it.
Yeah.
I did get up it, of course, when I came over Moab Saddle, but then
Okay.
I was down in the drainage of Shinumo there and really concerned. So I don't remember that being particularly bad
Okay.
bushwhacking.
So you get up to the saddle, you drop down the other side, you have to work your way back down through the red wall again, and there's one little way to kind of make that happen to get down into Tuna. And then Tuna is kind of a highway down to the river, unless you said, I'm going to stay on the top of the Tapetes.
Yeah, well, that's what I did, but I needed water.
Okay.
Yeah, so I went down Tuna to no, I'm sorry, I'm backing up here. I'm confusing another trip. There was a water hole in Tuna
Okay.
at the top of the Red Wall.
Okay.
And so I'm in a pocket, right?
Yep.
And so I filled up there
Okay.
and man, found the route down through the Red Wall, and my recollection of it is that it was fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
I was just back there 2.5 years ago.
Cool.
Story we'll talk about later, I think, I
Okay,
hope.
good.
And I had a lot more challenge.
Okay.
At you know, the second time I came through there. But the first time, I don't remember being anything, and I just went, got down through the red wall there and came into Tuna. And then just started walking along on the Tonto, you know, and you know, when you're on the Tonto, you can go forever. I mean, there's no logistical challenges, right? So at that point I knew I just had to walk.
So you would have crossed Crystal. You would have then back on the Tonto, walked forever, in and out and in and out and in and out and along.
Yeah.
But water would have been a little interesting. You would have bypassed 93 mile. You could have, but the water in there is kind of slimy. And then 91, you run into eventually Trinity, where the water's really bad.
Yeah.
So were you busting down to the river occasionally to try to get good water, or were you finding enough pothole water?
No, well, at that point I could move really fast, right? I was 19, right?
Okay.
And,
yeah.
And I mean, quite honestly, I was hiking in mountain boots, you know?
Okay.
That's what I hiked in at that time.
Yeah.
And so I would just get up, you know, when the light started.
Dawn.
And just start and be gone, right?
Okay.
So I got water in Crystal.
Okay.
And then I remember spending time in 94 mile, just like a couple of hours.
Okay.
Just relaxing. But there was no water there, I don't believe.
Right.
But there was water, you know, crappy water, as you mentioned, in Trinity. But then it was pretty good in 94 because you can get down the river there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, sorry, 91.
91.
Yeah. And so that's, but by there, you know, by that time you're almost at Phantom Ranch.
That's
so
right.
It wasn't that's big a deal. And I don't remember, I don't have a day by day account of hike.
No worries. We're now we really are, you know, close to the barn, because you're getting into this big island of supergroup, but you're still kind of on the Tonto level, the rock, but still, it's a fairly easy walk past the south side of Cheops, and then you come down Piano Alley, the little route that drops you down to the campground at Phantom Ranch.
Yeah, yeah, and there was a route there, you know, it was a trail.
Okay.
It was kind of nothing like it is now, but it was a trace route.
Yep.
And so, you know, it was fairly straightforward, and quite honestly, the way I came down was I basically went, if you follow along on the Tapetes, east of 91 mile, you're actually in the Precambrian there.
Right, that's a supergroup island. Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't have to, you know, there's a, I'm not, sh- maybe I'm confusing what you're calling the piano alley.
Well, you're not kind of at the Tonto level. You're a little lower, but there's this nice little sloping highway that runs along for a couple miles that then breaks you over to a little ridge, and you look down the ridge, and it's like, well, there's Phantom right below me.
Okay, but you can get down before that. You can get down and to the river and follow the old phone line. There's the old telephone line used to go along the river below the suspension bridge.
Okay.
The hiker's bridge.
Right. Okay.
And then it would cross, I guess, below that, about a half a mile down from there.
Okay.
And you can go straight up to that little bench you were talking about.
That makes sense. Okay,
yeah.
Sure.
And
sure.
So that's the way I went down, because it was straightforward.
So when you got to Phantom, did you check in with the ranger there? Do you remember who that person was?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Did
you talk
base.
To any of the Phantom people at all?
No, I didn't contact anybody
really?
There at all.
Huh?
And in fact, you know, at that point, I didn't even have, I mean, my cache was up in Phantom Creek.
Okay.
Okay, at the mouth of Phantom and Bright Angel, and I didn't even go up to the cache because I knew I was, you know, 4 hours from the car, right, or from the road.
I see.
And I just hightailed it out of there. I just wanted to be out of there.
So you just headed up to the north rim.
South rim.
Sorry, the south rim. Okay.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I was thinking, oh, you would have hitchhiked around, so you're just going to, where, did you leave your car at the south rim then?
No, I wouldn't have left my car up there, because I was, keep in mind, I was planning to do this for another 3 weeks, right, to hike from Phantom around to Nankoweap, and I wouldn't have left my car there that long. Quite honestly, Tom, I don't remember the setup I'd worked out, but
Okay.
I think the plan was just to go hitchhiking, just back to Phoenix.
So
And
I'm trying to think of how many people by 1973 that we have documentation for. Now, clearly the First Nation people would have been all over this route. But the documented people who traveled this route, Harvey would have pieced it together in pieces, but I don't know that he'd done that entire hike and in one fell swoop. Benson would have done it, but not many others.
yeah, and I guess my, that's part of the motivation that I wanted to do this hike was to do the Fletcher hike,
Okay.
but better, right? I mean, and when I say that better, I'm speaking somewhat facetiously, but it would have been on the North Rim, which I think is a more, geographically complex and more beautiful area, topographically complex for sure. And a little more remote and rugged than the South Rim access, that Fletcher had negotiated there his trip. So I just felt like, I mean, I was pretty naive, but I was thinking at the time, and I didn't know about Benson's hiking. And I thought, well, I could be the first person that's ever done the, the
And
north side
yeah, and
of the canyon.
Steck was in there as well at
No
one point.
doubt. Yeah.
But again, when? So I'm not real clear on that timeline. But yeah,
Yeah.
did you stop in and visit with Ernie on your way out at
You know,
South Rim?
I don't remember having a checkout with him, but I
Okay.
do remember that, I called in, right, and
Okay.
told them that at that time you could, go to the phone booth, and there was a number you could dial
Okay.
and let them know that you had made it out. And I think they actually had, I think we had voice answering machines then, tapes,
Okay.
I don't remember because I know that sometimes I got out of these hikes. And we would call in, and it would be late at night, and there obviously wouldn't have been a ranger there to take your call, so you would have left a message on the tape. I don't remember how it worked out with this trip, but
Okay.
I just, at that point, I'd been down there for, 5 weeks, and I'd had enough. I just wanted to get back to my parents' house and my girlfriend and everything else, and so,
Did you stop at the Bright Angel for a hamburger or something? Did you get something to eat up there?
I can't remember. Tom,
Okay.
quite honestly, I have no recollection of leaving Phantom Ranch. I remember getting there,
Okay.
and then,
Wow.
I just bolted for the South Rim and
Wow.
went home. So,
Amazing.
yeah, it was kind of, it was like, it was one of those trips that's kind of a love hate type thing, I
But
mean,
this
I was in.
sounds just so, so many people have had this. I got this vision. I'm going to go from point A to point B, and about halfway between point A to point B, I'm just lucky to be alive, and I'm bailing.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it was, and I mean, I know that I have I had I remember sitting there in some of my camps and thinking like this is the most marvelous place, that I could be, but also feeling the tension, and the anxiety and the questions in your mind. Am I going to be able to make it, over Shinumo Creek, and then what's Crystal Creek going to be like, and so all this foreboding, was constantly with me on that trip, and you have no way, to bounce it off somebody else, right? And because somebody else can, can often bring you back to reality and provide a perspective that's more rational, right?
That's right.
And so it was. I've never felt like that since in anything I've ever done. I have to say that, at this time when I was 19, that it was the single time in my life that I'd had that kind of an emotional experience. And I just, yeah. Well, anyways. Not much to say. I bolted out of there, and at the time, I probably thought I'm never coming back to the Grand Canyon,
But you did.
but I did,
Yeah.
yeah, and had many, many, many more stories. And so,
Well,
I
this
did want to say one thing that I forgot to mention.
Yeah.
But when I was on the Tonto there, coming around from Tuna, and passing Crystal and
Yep.
whatnot, of course you're walking along there, and you can look to the south. South side of the river, and you see Scylla Butte. You familiar with Scylla Butte?
Yep.
And And then I'm walking along, and then all of a sudden I'm walking along underneath the base of this tall Bright Angel Butte. This is on the north side of the river, between Crystal and Tuna.
Oh.
And I said to myself, well, this doesn't have a name on the map. It didn't have a name on the 1-2-625 map, but it's got to be Charybdis, you know, because the old mythology is that Scylla and Charybdis were two obstacles that Ulysses had to pass, you know, to return to his home. And so Scylla was a sea monster, and Charybdis was a giant whirlpool. And I saw, when I'm walking along here, I could see to the south Scylla Butte, named on the map, very obvious, prominent structure, and then this big butte rising right above me on the north side, unnamed. And I thought, well, that has to be Charybdis, you know, even though it's not named. So, anyways, I just was really struck by that at the time.
Hmm.
And that, you know, one of these buttes would have been named Scylla, and there wouldn't have been a comparable butte named Charybdis,
interesting,
right?
Interesting, yeah.
You know, it's kind of like one makes no sense without the other. And so I thought, well, this is something to think about for the future. And so that whole issue was something that, I won't say it haunted me, but it was, I thought about it. I have thought about it ever since. And eventually, a couple years ago, I'm happy to say that I was able to do the first ascent of Charybdis Butte.
Cool.
And it turns out that it's been subsequently located on the maps, but in the wrong place.
Cool.
So we may want to talk about that later. I don't know. But
why not?
But you know, this was for me to see this butte at that time. It was it was an obvious issue, right? There was something reaching out there that had to be answered. Like, why is Charybdis Butte not named? You know, why is just Scylla Butte named? And so eventually I tracked that down and got that
cool.
all sorted out. So.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Fun.
So, but, you know, that trip really, I got into a lot of country pretty quickly. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And a lot of country that I'd never experienced before. In a very dramatic way, and like, you know, first time down the North Pass, and first time into the Deer Creek area, and then of course having to deal with all these logistical challenges. It was
and Kanab and route finding and Shinumu. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Those are big side canyons.
Yeah,
that make a simple east-west traverse actually sort of a lot of north-south, north-south, north-south as you try to go east-west.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So that was a good learning. Experience too. Very
yeah.
cool. You know, this might be a good place to put a comma in this journey that we are taking, you and me.
Okay.
Because we've gone on an hour and 18, so that's all right.
Okay.
Let's do that. Is there anything else about this hike you want to add, or is this?
I think you know. I seem to feel like we've hit the high points.
Okay.
You know, I told you about how I was just emotionally spent by the time I finally crossed Shinumo Creek there and just collapsed and into crying. And then, you know, the fact that I wanted to get out and get away from the canyon was so, so strong at the end, and I've never felt that since, right?
Interesting.
Fortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, those were kind of important aspects, I think, of that. But, you know, that, you know, at the same time, there were so many new visions that I got to see, you know, and like this Charybdis Butte thing, like what's that all about, you know, and then of course you get these beautiful perspectives on the high summits in the canyon, like Confucius and Dragon and Ra and things like that. And
Evans
so
and Fen Island, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Doc's Castle and just all these, you know, Merlins and Modreds and, you know, all that. So,
Yeah.
Nice.
Fabulous place, so.
Nice. All right. Well, with that, let's go ahead and conclude part 3, Oral History with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday. Thank you very much. December 13th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. Jim, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Tom. I really appreciate the opportunity.